Hello, and welcome to the second annual Fundraising Success Virtual Conference and Expo. I'm Joe Boland, Senior Editor of Fundraising Success Magazine. Welcome to another great session designed to help you engage, enlighten, and empower donors, which, as you know, is the theme for today's conference. This session, Secrets to Success in the Small Shop, sponsored by the Fundraising School at the Center for Philanthropy at Indiana University, will focus on fundraising strategies for small organizations or development offices. But before we get started, there are a few technical pointers I need to share to ensure you get the most out of this session. This is an on-demand session, so if you have any technical difficulties while viewing, shoot us an email at virtualshowinfo@napco.com, and someone will get back to you promptly. To get a PDF version of the slide presentation for future reference, click on the Download Slides button on the console. If you leave the session at any time or would like to view it again later, you can access the entire presentation from the auditorium in the Fundraising Success Virtual Conference and Expo on-demand environment, which will be open for 3 months beginning on Monday, May 23rd, 2011. Finally, if you're on Twitter, we encourage you to tweet about the show today and this session. Please use the hashtag FSV2011 when doing so. To address the special challenges and opportunities of raising money in a small development office, we have fundraising coaches and consultants Sandy Reese and Pamela Grow, who are also Fundraising Success Little Shop columnists. And here's Sandy to kick things off.
Well, welcome, everybody. We're so glad that you're here with us. Talking about small shops and how to raise money in small shops is something that's very near and dear to my heart and to Pamela's as well, and we're so glad to be here with you. I want to start off by just saying, way to go working in a small shop. I've been there myself. I know it's not easy. I know that when you work in a small organization, you have a great many challenges, and I know that you wear a lot of hats. And if you can see the screen, I've got some great hats here. We've got the party hat because we've got to be able to put on great events that people like, right? Sometimes you got to be a maverick, so you got to have your cowboy hat. Things are always under construction, aren't they? Aren't we always building relationships or building things that are going to help us move toward our goals? You got to have your construction hat. There's a lot going on. I've been there and done that, and I know what you're dealing with. I know that you've got a lot of goals to reach and not an awful lot of time to do it. So I'm going to try to boil this down and make it really simple and give you some practical nuggets that you can walk away with and go implement right away, okay? So to reach your goals and wearing all those hats and all the other things that you have to do, there are several things you really need to do. You need to be real organized. You need to be real efficient with the things that you do, and you need to be real stingy with your time. And I know that time is one of the most precious things that we have for anybody working in fundraising, but especially in a small shop. So I'm going to encourage you to be really stingy with your time and to really start taking a good hard look at where you're spending your time so that you can make sure that you're doing those things that are going to move you toward your goals. I'll also encourage you to get help whenever you can, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about these as we go through. In other words, what you need to do is leverage. You're going to have to make sure that no matter what you're doing, you're getting the most return you can for your efforts. Kind of like riding on a little teeter-totter or a seesaw. You're going to make sure that when you sit on the one end, the other end definitely goes up. How do you leverage? You leverage by getting the most you can from things like your office. Are you getting the most you can from the systems you have in place? If you don't have any systems in place, then we're going to really talk about that a lot. How about your software or the support that you have around you? Are you getting the most that you can from your time? And are you getting the most you can from yourself? I can remember sitting in the chair of the development director, and there would be days maybe when I didn't feel so hot and I didn't feel like working really hard. And yet I had to dig really deep and find that place in myself that I could push forward and come up with the energy that I needed to go ahead and get things done. I remember what that feels like. Let's start with talking about systems. This is something that both Pamela and I feel really strongly about, and I think that this is a really important piece. A system is a method of doing something so that you get the same result every time. It's a practice that you're going to put into place so that you don't have to stop and rethink about how do you do something every time you address it. Things like gift entry for thanking your donors or creating a newsletter. You don't want to reinvent the wheel every time, so you're going to create a system. One of the most important pieces of systems is to have procedures, written procedures in place. And I know that some people are you're going to look at this and go, oh, you've got to be kidding. But trust me, this will really make your life easier and help you get more accomplished. Take advantage of your time and your opportunities. And I've even got a little sample gift entry procedure here. It might be simple things like step one, open the envelope. Step two, identify the source of the gift. And step three, find the donor in the software, and so forth. But see what happens with with systems is that every time you do it, you're going to make sure it's done in the same way. And then when you start to get help, whether you've got volunteers or maybe you get an intern or maybe the day comes that you can hire more staff, it's going to be a lot easier to bring other people along and show them what needs to be done when you have systems in place. It really does make life a lot easier. Another way that you can think about having a look at systems in your office is think about it graphically. You might need to put a flow chart together that would help you and also help other people that you need to show what's happening. By the way, this works great with volunteers. I know that some folks get a little resistant about volunteers. Maybe you've had a bad experience with volunteers, but I'm going to tell you what. When I sat as the sole development person, volunteers saved me so many times because they were willing to do things, and when I could show them what needed to be done and be very clear about it, they were so happy to give me a hand and to help out.
Hey,
so,
Sandy.
One of
the questions that comes up quite a bit is how do you get the most out of your volunteers when their time is as limited as you know yours is as a small nonprofit organization? Do you have any hints on that?
Yeah, actually I do, and that's a great question. Thanks, Joe. Here's what I have found works really well with volunteers. The first thing is you've got to be very clear about the job that you want a volunteer to do. So even before they show up to interview or to help you out, you need to be very clear about what you want them to do. Then you can make sure that they're focused and that their time is being well spent when they do show up to help. There's also a way that you can match a volunteer and their talents and skills with the job that you need done. That also helps set a volunteer up for success and then helps them want to come back. So, for example, one of the things that I did with volunteers when I worked at the food bank, I had volunteers who came and helped me fold and stuff thank you letters. As I looked at systems and I looked at leveraging myself, I recognized that I didn't necessarily need to be the person who was stuffing thank you letters, that I needed to be making phone calls to major donors. I needed to be writing grants. I needed to be doing other things. So I recruited volunteers, first by being very clear about what I needed done, then talking to different people and finding those people who thought that job sounded like fun. Then when they came in to do the job, I got them oriented. I showed them where the bathroom was. I introduced them to everybody, and I encouraged them to have some fun. I made them feel comfortable. I would check on them. I smiled a lot and was very upbeat with them and thanked them profusely for helping. And then they wanted to come back and come back and come back. So it wasn't anything real difficult. A lot of it was just putting some real common sense things into place. But that is definitely a way to utilize a volunteer so that they feel their time is well spent and you get the result that you want. Yeah, anything you do more than once should really have a system for it. So you're going to want to start keeping your eyes open for all those things that you're doing on a daily basis that need a system. One of the things that I used to hate was when I would figure out something. Like there were sometimes credit cards that I needed to process manually, and I literally had to get the manual out to go look and see how to do this. Well, I would only do it about every 6 or 8 weeks, and it just drove me crazy because I had to reinvent the wheel every time until I started to think, what if I were to write this down for myself, step one, do this, step two, do that, step three, do the next thing, and then it would work for me. So I did, and it worked. It wasn't anything earth-shattering, but it did take me a little time to finally realize that that's what I needed to do and to put that thing into place. So systems are best when...
Can I make one little comment, Sandy?
You bet. Jump in here.
Yay, because you're also setting it up for the person who's going to come after you, too.
Oh,
and I think we've all
walked
into that situation where I know that I've been like the fifth development director in 3 years, and there aren't any of those systems in place to tell me what's going on. And it takes forever to get up to speed.
Yeah.
Just wanted
and you
to
know
say
the,
that.
And thank you, Pamela. That's awesome. And you know the other thing that happens? The other thing that happens sometimes when you don't have systems in place to ensure that smooth transition is balls can start to get dropped and relationships with donors can start to get dropped and acknowledgement can start to get dropped, and that's not stuff you want to drop. You want to make sure that there's a smooth transition, and systems will help you do that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So make sure they're in writing, make sure they're clear, make sure that people who are going to use them understand them. The next thing that I want to point out is software. You need to make sure that you have the right tools that are going to support you to be successful in your job. You know, when you're the loan development director, you are, you're the talent. You know, look at it like some, a singer like Beyonce. You know, Beyonce does not, doesn't book the shows and sell the tickets. Beyonce shows up and sings, right? Now, obviously, you're going to have to do some stuff as the development director, but if there are things that you can delegate or things that you can start to use other tools to help you, then you need to do that. You need to make sure that you're focusing on those things that only you can focus on.
Yeah, and Sandy, there's a question here regarding software, too. Specifically, what kind of information should smaller organizations have, and how do they keep track of each interaction they have with each contact? Is there a certain kind of donor management software they should be using, and what sort of analytics should they really focus on?
That's a great question. I believe that every organization needs to have some kind of donor tracking software. You know, trying to do this in an Excel sheet or not do it at all is really not going to cut it. You need to have some kind of software, and you need to use it. If you're using a donor tracking software, it really doesn't matter which one you pick. It's going to have some way for you to record the interactions that you have with your donors. Some of it's really simple. You know, sometimes when you're pulling a list of people that you want to send a newsletter to, at the same time you're pulling the list, you can tell it to tag those donors that they've received the newsletter. So it's not difficult at all. If you're talking about major donors, then you're going to have a notes section in that software where you can go just jot down a few things about taking the donor to lunch or what they said, their favorite thing about your organization was, and so forth. A couple of things about tracking information on major donors. One is, you know, hit the highlights definitely and make sure that there's enough information that the next time you pull that record up, it makes sense to you, but don't put anything in the donor's record that you wouldn't show the donor in person. The donor has the right to see their donor record, and you don't want to put things in there like drinks too much at the annual event and dances on the table, you know, gets obnoxious and those sort of things. You know, but certainly if the donor has a private family foundation, you can put that in the notes. Or if they say they love one particular program your organization has, put that in the notes. Those are the kind of things that are going to help you later. I can remember doing that sort of thing. I can actually remember the very first time I took a major donor to lunch, and the things that she said to me were so surprising because it wasn't what I expected at all. I sort of thought I knew why somebody might give to a food bank, and her answers blew me away. So that was the kind of thing that I wanted to go back and put in her file, that she said she loved the food bank because blah, blah, blah. That was great information I needed for later. There's a couple of other kinds of things you want to look at when you're thinking about software. In addition to donor tracking software, you're going to want some kind of online tool to help you accept online donations and something to help manage your website. I was with a group of people yesterday, and we were talking about how important it is for you to be able to go make text changes yourself on your own website instead of waiting for a volunteer or somebody else to update your website, which can take a lot of time.
Or could happen to a webmaster.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Or if you have a volunteer who then turns around and holds your website hostage and won't make changes. I mean, that's so painful. So I really recommend you get something that you can do it yourself. And there are tools out there like WordPress that you can build a simple website in and then make changes, and it's really quite simple. Or if you're going to be doing your own newsletter, you may want some kind of layout software like a page maker or something that makes it easy. I do think it's real important to have help in your office, and I know that there are a lot of people who get into some kind of control freak thing, and they don't want other people coming in and helping because they think that somebody else wouldn't do it the same way. Well, they won't do it as well. They won't do it right. I'll have to go back and do it myself. You know what? You're going to have to dump that kind of thinking. That thinking is not going to support you. What you need to figure out is what are the things that absolutely have to be done a certain way, and then what else can be done a different way and still be just as good. Then you can get help. You can recruit volunteers, as we talked about earlier. You can get an intern from your local college. I've had some great success with interns over the years. Or you might even outsource and find somebody who could help you get things done in your office. The point is, it doesn't all have to be on your plate unless you just want it to be all on your plate. These kind of help is going to work best, as we mentioned earlier, when you're real clear about what needs to be done. Then you've got to provide good training. Get people oriented and help them have fun, and they're going to want to come back and be willing to give up control. Now, I mentioned a couple of times earlier about being really stingy with your time, and I think this is a really important piece for so many of us. The first thing you want to do is have real clear goals about what you need to be accomplishing in your office. I know that when you are the one person working in fundraising, it can seem like you're dealing with the crisis du jour, and I remember being in that situation very well. But what I want to say to you now is you need to start to turn things around so that you're not being reactive to whatever comes along and you are being proactive and working toward goals. Once you set some goals, make sure that everything you do moves you toward that goal. Then start saying no to everything else. Now, that's going to be a huge shift for some people, I realize. But I'm going to tell you what, it will move you toward success so much faster, and it will move you toward raising money so much faster. How that plays out in reality sometimes is that you may be working on a goal of raising, let's say, $10,000 through grant money, and you're doing grant research, and maybe your executive director pops in or your board president pops in and says, hey, I've got this great idea for this event I want to do. And what do you do about that? How do you deal with that? Well, you know what? If you have some real clear goals set and they're in writing, then it's pretty easy to sit down with that person and say, okay, let me show you what I already have planned, and let me show you what we already have coming up. And I only have so much time during the day that I can work on these things. So if I take on your project too, something else is going to have to go. I think this is a conversation that so many of us don't have. We just take on the additional thing without any discussion at all, and then we start to get really resentful because now we have too much on our plate. So I would encourage you to be willing to sit down and say, you know what, I'm not happy to do that, but something's going to have to go. Also, watch out for time leaks. Time leaks are those things that will just drain your time away, like, let's say, playing on Facebook. And I know so many of us are guilty. We're guilty of getting on Facebook. I intend to spend 5 minutes a day on Facebook, and I wind up a half hour just in the morning. And what I know for myself is when I'm doing that, I'm playing. And then when I catch myself, I say, whoop, wait a minute, time to focus. Got to get back to what I was doing. You have to start really watching yourself and your time. Here's a couple of real practical tips that you can take away. And the first one is turn your email off during the day. Close it. You can jump in on email, check it first thing in the morning, deal with anything you need to, then turn it off. Because what happens during the day, every time you get an email, you get that little thing that pops up. And if you're like most everybody else in the world, we go immediately to see what the email was about, and we get distracted from whatever the thing was that we were doing. If you were doing prospect research, or if you were writing a system, or whatever it was you're doing, is now going to take you several times longer to do because you got interrupted. So if you turn that email off during the day, it's going to help you. You can open it up at lunch if you want to, check it, close it back again. Open it up at the end of the day, check it, close it back again. Just that one simple thing will save you so much time and make you so much more productive. You might do the same thing with your phone, too. If there's going to be times during the day when you really need to concentrate, turn the phone off. I would encourage you to cluster similar tasks. If you know that you've got several things that need to be written, maybe you need to write a page for the website and you've got a newsletter article that needs to be written, cluster those things together. When you get into writing mode, stay in writing mode. Don't bounce from one thing to the next. If you'll cluster those tasks, you'll be more productive. Also, be real sensitive to your productive time of day. Some of us are better in the morning, some better in the evening. So focus on that. Take advantage of it. Delegate, automate, or delete. If there are things you can give to other people, do it. If there are things you can automate, do it. If there are tasks you can just say, you know what, it's really not that important, I'm going to delete it off, do that. You'll find that it really frees up an awful lot of time. I want to encourage you to evaluate opportunities carefully, because here's what I know happens. We set out a day or a week and we say, okay, here's what I'm going to get accomplished. and yet all kinds of things can happen. You can get a call from a TV station saying, hey, we want to come and do a story. Or you can get a call from a board member who says, hey, I've got a prospective sponsor for that event. You need to give them a call. Stuff pops up, and sometimes it's all really good stuff. So what you need to do is be in a situation where you can start to really evaluate new opportunities to decide if they're worth the time. You don't want to necessarily respond to everything because not everything is worth your time. So really go for the low-hanging fruit that's going to reward you well. If it's not going to bring you donations or publicity or deepen or strengthen relationships or bring you some goodwill of some way, then why are you doing it? And I'm going to tell you, it's okay to tell a board member or to tell somebody else no, you know? I've been there. I've done it. I know that you can do it and survive it. Another really important thing that I want to share with you is to keep your head in the game. I know this kind of seems kind of funny, but here you go. So many times when we work in organizations that we consider small, we get the small organization mentality. Oh, well, we're just a small organization. We can't do this like the big organizations, or we can't do that. I would encourage you to dump that kind of thinking. I call it actually stinking thinking. Because you wind up talking yourself out of doing things that are really pretty important and that could bear a lot of fruit for you. Focus on what can be done instead of what can't. Nothing makes me crazier as a coach than talking to somebody who says, well, we can't do that. We can't do this. We can't do whatever. You just don't even want to be working with me if you start saying that stuff. Because I'll give you a lot to think about. Focus on what you can do and realize that your organization is just as worthy as any other nonprofit that's out there. You might also think about your beliefs about money and how they can help or hurt you. You know, some of us have beliefs around things like that money really is, money's a bad thing, or rich people are greedy, or you know, we're not supposed to have money. Only the meek people who are poor, you know, are really worthy. You know, that, a lot of that is just a lot of crap. And sometimes we feel a little intimidated, or we feel a little unworthy because of these beliefs and how they creep in. I've seen an awful lot of people who are so uncomfortable asking for a gift above a certain dollar amount because of some belief they have rolling around in their head. So I'd encourage you to dig into some of that kind of stuff. Really watch what you think and what you say, especially around money or around fundraising. Never say things like, well, we got to hit up old so-and-so for money. You're not hitting anybody up. You're going to ask people to make a gift to support the work that you're doing. I could go on and on and on about that kind of thing, but I think you get the point. It's just to really watch what you think and what you say about fundraising and about raising money. I've got a few resources here for you. If you're looking for software, go to idealware.org. They have some great information there. If you're thinking about how can I get the word out, or how can I look at systematizing some of my marketing, Nonprofit Marketing Guide has some great resources there, as does GailPerry.com. These are some websites that I've spent a lot of time on and really recommend them. So go raise some money. Yay?
Yay.
Well, thank you very much, Sandy. And now we're going to pass it off to Pamela.
Well, hey, everybody. Welcome, and thanks for having me here today. And that was terrific, Sandy. I loved so much of what you said, and I could really, really empathize with it. My name's Pamela Groh, and I am, let's see here. My site is PamelaGroh.com. I'm the creator of Simple Development Systems. We're going to talk a little bit, first of all, about what a loan development director looks like. Well, this is what I always felt like I was spinning a million plates in the air.
I love it. I love it, love it, love it.
Because Sandy knows it is crazy. It's absolutely crazy. I've been there, too. I know what it's like to be trying to get an annual appeal out to 500 people, and I'm using Microsoft Word, you know, 2003, and it's 2007, and I'm printing on a donated printer that seizes up after every 100 letters, and I'm doing this all myself, well, with the help, too, of volunteers. But it can be a bit of a nightmare. You're juggling grant writing and grants management, events, individual giving, online giving, putting together your website a lot of times, maintaining it, database management, stewardship, social media, board fundraising, corporate sponsorship, meeting with donors, and so many other things, and it just all adds up to insanity. And this is what a lot of us feel like. It is crazy. Is it any wonder that the average length of stay for a nonprofit development director is 18 months? And that's what really hurts this field, I think, because there is such a lack of continuity in so many small organizations. So I'm going to talk a little bit today about four things that you can do to increase your return on investment. And to my mind, the most important is to love your donors.
Mm-hmm.
Recognize that in everything you do, donor centricity is key. And I've talked to a lot of fundraisers who I don't think really quite get donor centricity, and it can be a hard concept to grasp. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit, and I'm going to talk about the easiest way to ensure that all your communications throughout are totally donor-centric. The best way is to create a detailed donor profile. Sandy, have you read Relationship Fundraising by Ken Burnett? I think you have.
Yeah, I love Ken Burnett.
One of my favorite parts about the book, I've got it here in front of me, is how he's got these detailed donor profiles scattered throughout. He talks about where they get their groceries, what time they eat dinner at night. And this is actually a practice that I just put to a couple of my coaching clients, and it was a real eye-opener. What you do typically is you take between 10 and 20 random donors, loyal donors from your database, and just sort of go through and try to figure out some commonalities. Getting a blank slide. What's her level of education? What other organizations does she contribute to? What's her income level? Where does she live? Where does she shop? Really drill this process down as much as humanly possible. I like to even put a name to my donor. Oops, sorry about that. What does she do for fun? Is she married? Does she have children? What are their ages? Where do they go to school? What's her political affiliation? Where does she get her groceries? What church does she go to? What community does she live in? Really drill this down, and you'll come up with a detailed donor profile that's going to be your first step towards donor centricity. And it's going to give you, when you sit down to write your communications pieces, whether you're writing email, whether you're writing direct mail, whether you're writing a newsletter, it's more like you're writing to a friend. And it makes the whole practice of your writing, which is where a lot of people seize up, and a lot of people have trouble with, it'll make it go a lot smoother. Number two is to practice WOW stewardship. Always remember, and I do believe I got this from Tom Ahern, but I couldn't find it to attribute it. A first-time gift is like a first date. It's not a marriage proposal. And donor attrition statistics are in the toilet. Really terrible. These are some of the latest from 90% of donors who start contributing to a particular cause. They stop giving by the fifth renewal request. This is from Penelope Burke. And 8 out of 10 first-time donors do not make a second gift. That's a real killer. So what can you do to avoid that, to make sure that your first-time donors become loyal donors? First off is your thank you letter. Your thank you letter is your most important step, and it's a wonderful opportunity. It's the best opportunity. So why would you waste a prime opportunity to engage your donor on a letter that reads like this? And this is something I picked up. I can't remember where I got it online. It's a letter from a grandson to his grandmother thanking her for a pair of socks, and it's written in typical nonprofit speak that we're all pretty familiar with.
That's really funny.
If we're honest with ourselves, but this is how most nonprofit organizations are communicating. I had a little movie clip in here, but remember the power of words and learn how to use them. It's one of the most important tools you'll have. There's other ways you can wow your donors. Make it a habit to personally thank one donor a day. Back when I was actually working as a development director, I got in the habit, and I was so grateful that I found this. Did you ever read that article by Hilde Gottlieb, Sandy?
Which one?
Called The Sound a Thank You Makes.
Yes.
I read that article years ago, and it made such a huge difference. And after I read that article, every day I would spend 30 minutes on the phone calling donors to thank them. And it's, aside from the fact that it builds such goodwill, it also creates some incredible content for your marketing, because you hear about what your organization really means to the donor. You create a relationship. It's just really, really works well. Create a wow calendar. I call it a wow calendar. Instead of the typical card occasions where you're going to be lost in the Me Too, like Christmas, send a card on Thanksgiving. How appropriate. for Valentine's Day. Make it a practice to survey your donors regularly, even monthly. And this doesn't have to be a big thing, but it's going to add to your efforts tenfold. One of the first things I did, I don't know if I've ever told you this story, Sandy. I had just started as a nonprofit development director, and I'd come from working in foundation for Family Grant Making Foundation for 7 or 8 years. And I became acquainted with all these different organizations, so I always thought I'd like to be a fundraiser, but I had no clue what I was doing. All I really knew was how to write a grant proposal. And I came into this job, and it took me about a week to say, oh, my God, I have no idea what I'm doing. But one of the first things I did was to pull our database, and I pulled up about 20 names of loyal donors. I wrote a letter of introduction. I sent a little survey asking them why they had given to us for the last 5 or 10 years or whatever, however long they'd given, and I enclosed a self-addressed stamped envelope. And all but two of them responded. Several of them sent in really substantial checks, and their responses formed the basis of my first annual appeal, which was also incredibly successful. So you don't have to think about surveying everybody. You could just put together a survey of, say, a percentage of your email subscribers. But it's very important to get their feedback.
On a similar note, there's a question here about recurring gifts or monthly pledges and thanking donors. And the question is it okay to send a year-end tax receipt for all the monthly payments, or do donors need and expect to receive an acknowledgement for each month's payment?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that one, because I asked Lisa Sargent about that. She's a donor retention expert. Sending an acknowledgement for every month's payment is actually a little bit irritating. You don't need to do that, but you do need to be acknowledging your monthly donors. Lisa's advice was, and I thought she gave some great advice, so I'm actually going to read from it verbatim. She said, don't stop communicating. When donors commit to monthly giving, they somehow enter a kind of donor communications wasteland. She said at one organization that she knows of, they were actually taken off all the mailing lists for fear that if a stray ass crept in, mutiny would follow. When in fact the opposite is true, relevant, regular, well-crafted asks have been shown to increase engagement. To steward sustainers, you can and should keep sending appeals that you're going to modify and you're going to acknowledge their monthly giving. And you're also going to create some sort of special program, maybe a special newsletter that only your monthly givers get. Let's see what else she said. Don't forget bequest appeals. Send them special versions of your regular communications. She says, one of my clients encloses a one-sheet note from the president, especially for monthlies and majors, along with the quarterly newsletter. Of course, it's labeled President's Report for Major Donors or Name of Giving Club of Charity. Periodically offer them some special opportunities like events, guided tours, send special thank yous. She said one of her past clients had published a number of great coffee table books. They would send surplus editions as thank yous to monthly givers during the holidays.
I'll jump in and say that, I think that a lot of monthly donors do get really irritated if you send them that monthly thank you. But I think what happens, and just like Lisa said, you got to look for those opportunities to get a little creative in thanking those people, because they do still need to be thanked and they do still need to be communicated with, but just not in the same old way.
Oh, exactly, because they're extra special.
Mm-hmm.
37% of donors in the UK are monthly givers. Of course, it's been, of course, much bigger in the UK and Canada and Australia. These are a couple of, I interviewed Harvey McKinnon, who wrote the book Hidden Gold. I guess it was last year. Generally speaking, on an annual basis, each person that converts to monthly giving gives 2 to 3 times more money, and some of them even more.
Mm-hmm.
And Harvey told me about his very, very first campaign, and it was kind of interesting to me because his very first campaign, I think he said he had 3 donors, and one of them was him. they take a while to grow, but he also told me that, I'm paraphrasing here because I don't remember exactly what he said. I'll have to look back at it, but I think it was like 20 years later, those 2 donors had become major donors, and they were still giving monthly.
Hmm.
So it's imperative that every organization start a monthly giving campaign. If an organization is converting 1 to 2% of their file every year, by the end of a decade, around 10 to 20% of their monthly donors would be on a monthly giving program. It does take a while to grow, but you always want to always want to think of the lifetime value of the donor.
Mm-hmm.
I can't emphasize that enough. The key with monthly giving is to begin. Monthly giving has to be nurtured. It's not something that you just put out there and forget about, which I have seen happen with some small organizations. And again, Sandy, that's something that goes back to what you talked about earlier with systems. I think, you got a newbie coming on board and they don't know about the monthly giving program, or they just let it slide. And we're on the same page here. Create systems for grant success, including weekly foundation prospect research. I firmly believe that every organization, if they're serious about grants, they need to conduct regular weekly foundation prospect research. It's amazing to me that I've been living here in the Philadelphia region for about 23 years. I still find new funders that I had never heard of. You want systems for stewardship, systems for database management. Again, Excel is not a database. So. And it's not so much the tool, although you really want to check out at least 3 or 4 tools. It's figuring out what you want to get out of it and setting up procedures for that, for the data entry, systems for social media, systems for everything. And then I've got a couple resources here, too, as well. One of my favorites is Sophie. Sophie is the fundraiser swipe file. They have exhibits of some of the best campaigns ever run. I was talking with a friend of mine last week, and he was telling me about a fellow he knew who had started a very, very tiny nonprofit on a shoestring budget. I don't even think he got a salary for years. And he didn't know anything about fundraising. But what he did was he started to collect the best annual appeals that came in his mailbox, and he actually tailored them to fit his own organization. And he had great success with that. So he was using swipe files without even knowing it. But Sophie is an amazing resource. So is, I tell everybody to subscribe to Tom Ahern's newsletter. And
mm-hmm.
I tell everybody to subscribe to Lisa Sargent's newsletter. Her E-Means the Loyalty letter is just awesome. And back to you, Joe.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Pamela and Sandy. And because this is an on-demand session, there won't be a live Q&A with the audience. But we do have some questions from fundraisers who were polled ahead of time. So let's take some time to delve into those. And specifically, we'll start one of the last things that Pamela mentioned there was social media. And there is quite a bit of social media questions we got. And one of the challenges is, how do you staff people for social media when there's so little staff to go around and so little time? Is it a good idea to recruit an eager, capable volunteer to scope out the landscape and come up with an approach to using social media that will start to engage supporters, identify new friends of the nonprofit, build relationships via these media who in time may become donors?
Could I take that, Sandy?
Okay.
I'll start. I did talk to John Hayden about that because I asked him, if you're a small nonprofit and you're really time strapped and you have to pick one social media tool, which one should it be? And his response was, of course, Facebook. 670 million people are on it. Half of them log on every day and they spend at least 30 minutes every day. And you talked earlier, Sandy, about giving up control a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I had an interview with, did you happen to read the article about this fellow who has raised $100,000 in monthly giving via Facebook?
No, that's great.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, when I think of Facebook, when I think of social media fundraising, I think of one-off gifts. I know that for every gift that I've made on Facebook to a birthday cause, I've never gotten a thank you from or even a follow-up from the organization. So I'm always questioning, how can we actually build relationships on social media? And I talked with Leonard Coyne, he actually is the head of fundraising for Soy Dog Foundation, the organization that raised $100,000 in monthly giving on Facebook. And he told me that a huge part of his success was relinquishing control. By that, I mean that he actually gave administrative rights to key volunteers and staff members. So you can think about how you could give some admin rights to some of your volunteers, some of your staff members, maybe even donors, who could be a great source of content.
You know, one of the things that strikes me about social media is there's so many nonprofits that say, oh, well, we got to be on Facebook. Oh, we got to be on Twitter. And I'll say, why? And they say, because everybody else is.
Yeah.
You know, and I get tickled with that. But then I say to them, okay, let's focus for a minute, and I want you to get real clear about your purpose. You know, you got to get real clear about why do you want to be on Facebook or why do you want to have a blog. And those things are great. But here's the thing. If you're the loan development director and you already have a full plate, you might need to get some other stuff really running well first before you take on additional responsibilities in terms of social media. Or you might need to go find that volunteer who's going to be excited and ready to run with some stuff and ready to spend some time on Facebook and so forth. So I think it's very difficult to say, here's what you ought to do. I think it sort of depends on the individual organization and the individual development director and what their talents and gifts are.
Okay, and that kind of goes into this next question, is that there almost seems to be somewhat of a contradiction in the fact that a lot of Facebook users are younger, and where the donors are still in the 50-plus to 60-plus age group. And it seems to lead to using more traditional marketing for traditional donors. So how do you balance between new media and the tried and true methods?
Well, you know, some of the statistics that I have seen show that the fastest growing group on Facebook is those of us who are middle-aged. You know, in that 50 plus. You know, you've got an awful lot of people who are on there keeping up with people for their 20th high school reunion. You've got a lot of grandparents who are keeping up with their grandkids. So I would say be very careful about making any generalization about who is or isn't on Facebook. And the other thing is, I think if we as nonprofits don't get on Facebook or any of the social media and start to engage the younger generation, in 10 or 20 years, we're going to be way behind, because the organizations who are finding ways to engage the younger generation are going to be leaps and bounds ahead of the curve.
That's such a good point, Sandy. I mean, I remember when boards were arguing about whether or not their organization should have a website.
Yeah, me too.
And it shows now, because, I mean, you look at so many nonprofit websites and they're a good 10 years behind the times.
Yeah.
I'm not saying leap into it, but I do think that you need to establish a presence. I don't know about Twitter. Twitter's great for me, but I haven't seen a lot of success with nonprofits using it, unless they've got a social media manager, a larger nonprofit.
There are some, but again, it goes back to being very clear about why you're doing it and the result that you want
exactly.
to get.
Exactly.
And then with all this new technology, it's pretty easy to get caught up in the latest trends without kind of figuring out how it will benefit your nonprofit's mission, just like you were saying. So what are, you know, three things that a one-person shop or a smaller shop should do every week to ensure they're bringing in the money to support their mission?
Well, clearly thanking donors is one. Anything that can be done to thank or wow a donor, I think, has to be done every week, if not every day. I would say probably number two is probably just telling your story, getting out there and letting people know what it is you're doing and how your organization is making a difference in the community.
Exactly. I also like to tell people to reconnect with their mission. Sometimes there can be, even in a small office, a sort of a disconnect between program staff and fundraisers.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for a small education nonprofit for a number of years, and I always made it a practice, usually about once a week, to actually shadow one of our site directors as they worked with the kids to find out what they were really doing. And I, you know, set up times to talk with the parents of the kids to find out how their kids had improved, what challenges their kids were going through. It really helped in terms of telling your organization's story.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. And shifting gears a little bit, kind of questions in dealing with your board, how do you politely enlist the support of board members to network and spread the word and wave the flag of your organization to people they meet and do business with, you know, in their everyday work lives?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? everybody wants to know. Here's one thing that I think will be very helpful, and that is that if we as staff or development folks would just realize that when somebody says yes to being on our board, doesn't mean that they automatically download everything they need to know to be a good board member or everything they need to know about our organization. So we need to do a lot of support. We need to give them a lot of help so that they know what they need to say and they know how to go out and be a good ambassador. We can't just assume that they know. We got to help them go and do those things.
That's so true.
Yeah.
One of my friends, she likes to open all their board meetings with what she calls a mission moment. You know, I can't remember if that was Lori or Pam, but, you know, it's so easy to get lost. For staff, you know, you get lost in the minutia of the day and the day-to-day work, and board members get lost in running a board. And so make sure that you spend a good 5 to 10 minutes prior to beginning every meeting reconnecting with the mission.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and even be real clear with them about what you want them to do to go out and spread the word. You know, it's real easy, as I sit on a board, for our development director to say, okay, I need everybody to go be a good ambassador in the community. Well, I don't necessarily know what he means by that. So I need him to tell me, okay, if you could talk to 3 people this week about our organization and tell them why you like it, and then I can say, oh, got it. Now I know what I need to do. So there's really something to be said for being very clear.
Well, another thing that's good is to get your board members involved in thanking, whether you give them, you know, short lists of people to call and thank, or one of my clients, they actually have during intermission at their board meetings, they'll spend like 15 minutes to half an hour, and they'll pass out note cards and names and have them handwrite thank you notes.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a great, great use of board members' time.
Okay, well, it looks like we are just about out of time here. So on behalf of Fundraising Success Magazine and the Fundraising School, thanks again for attending this virtual conference and expo. If you're interested in discussing anything that you heard during the presentation this afternoon, we encourage you to visit the Networking Lounge to chat live with other session attendees. Please also check out the agenda for the rest of the day today. We have several wonderful sessions lined up and encourage you to view as many as you can. Remember, if you can't watch them live, add them to your briefcase and view at your convenience in the on-demand environment. I'd like to thank our presenters again. Thanks very much, Sandy and Pamela, and everyone have a great day. Thanks.